That's Ramsey Lewis, Chicago born. And his trio, the Ramsey Lewis Trio, with Wade in the Water, the title track of his 1966 album. It was recorded live at the Bohemian Caverns in Washington, D.C. in 1965. Of course, Ramsey Lewis on piano, John Avant on trombone, Cleveland Eaton on bass, and Maurice White, yes, the Maurice White of Earth, Wind, and Fire on drums. Ramsey Lewis is still going strong at 81 years of age. This is Lead Stories. I'm Eutrice Lead. And what's better than having our guest today just once in a very, very wonderful program that we had yesterday? What's better is having him twice. And today is that day, the follow-up of yesterday's program with Dr. Gerald Horn. Today he's going to just finish up on making observations on the parallels between the political evolutions that are occurring in the United States and that of South Africa, where there was an extraordinary development in the most recent election that took almost 4 days to certify, but led to an extraordinary and stunning conclusion. On yesterday's program, as I said, Dr. Gerald Horn offered a comprehensive analysis of election 2016 and the many reasons that it is a watershed moment in U.S. social and political history. So today he returns to engage with you. I'm expecting you to call in at 888-874-4888 as soon as he finishes off with this piece on South Africa's elections and the significance of those elections. Dr. Horn is the John J. and Rebecca Moores Chair of History and African American Studies at the University of Houston. He is the author of more than 30 books and 100 scholarly papers on struggles against imperialism, colonialism, fascism, and racism. But we know him here on Lead Stories as the great decoder of very complex issues that we're dealing with. But he always manages to give us the most perfect context for everything that we are experiencing today. And many of the times we're thinking that this is happening for the first time. And only when we engage with Dr. Horn do we appreciate the precedence for many of the things that we think are happening for the first time. And he's unapologetically leftist, very radical in his views. That doesn't mean he's crazy. It means that he is very radical in his views. A highly respected historian who continues to contribute to documenting the missing pages of our collective history through his relentless research. Thanks, Gerald, for being with us again today.
Well, thank you for inviting me.
Okay. We didn't get a chance to talk about the elections in South Africa and why they, too, are significant. In the same way that the United States is experiencing a historic moment, we agree on that. What is historic about the election, the just concluded election in South Africa?
Well, first of all, the ruling African National Congress, the party of Nelson Mandela, suffered something of a setback. Its poll numbers up until this point had been about 62-63%, and they fell by 10 points. However, before you rush to see that as some sort of victory for progress, keep in mind that those 10 points were basically absorbed by the so-called Democratic Alliance, the opponents of the African National Congress, which in many ways is the descendant of the old National Party of F.W. de Klerk, that is to say the so-called Reform Party of Apartheid, which now has a kind of black face, even though the rank and file is not black. And even though many in your audience would be expecting and pushing for a radical redistribution of the wealth in South Africa, that would be rather difficult in light of the fact that the old party of apartheid has done better in this election than they've done in previous elections, and the ANC has not done very well. Likewise, a so-called victor in this election was the Economic Freedom Fighters, founded and led by Julius Malema, a former ANC member who once was cited and quoted for the proposition that he would die and kill for Jacob Zuma, but then, of course, he had a falling out with Jacob Zuma, being the Jacob Zuma, of course, the president of the ANC and president of South Africa. He started the Economic Freedom Fighters, and in his platform and program, they push for radical redistribution in terms of land reform. And your listeners might think that that would be a positive signal, but keep in mind that the Economic Freedom Fighters apparently are so upset with the ANC that they have said that in regard to those cities, Johannesburg, Pretoria, Nelson Mandela Bay, formerly Port Elizabeth, that the ANC has lost control of, rather than go into coalition with ANC, they have at least to this point expressed the preference for going into coalition with the Democratic Alliance, those who are diametrically opposed to their platform of redistribution, which obviously is contradictory and does not speak well with regard to the future of solving the question of poverty and inequality in South Africa, which by some accounts is as bad or worse than it was under the worst days of apartheid. Now, I think it might be useful to get a little historical perspective on these 2016 elections, and this won't take long, but I'll go back to 1652 when the Dutch settlers first arrived at the tip of South Africa. Keep in mind that this is also taking place, not coincidentally, as European settlers are coming across the Atlantic to North America. And in fact, there's long been a close tie between colonial settlement in South Africa and in North America, which is one of the reasons why South Africa has struck such a resonant chord on these shores, because of the parallel histories over the decades and over the centuries. The Dutch, as you know, were supplanted at the beginning of the 19th century by the British. And then when the British moved to abolish slavery in their empire in the 1830s, you had many of these Afrikaners, as they now call themselves, or Dutch settlers, fleeing into other parts of southern Africa so they could continue slavery. Keep in mind that the U.S. slave traders, who began to captain the international slave trade after Britain was ousted from that leadership position by the rise of the United States, these U.S. slave traders who were trying to snatch Africans from Mozambique in particular on the Indian Ocean coast, oftentimes sailed through Cape Town for provisions and, of course, collaborated very closely with their brethren, their European brethren in South Africa in terms of the international slave trade. And, of course, the U.S. and the Afrikaners collaborated in trying to foil British abolition beginning in the 1830s. And keep in mind as well that at the end of the 19th century, when the so-called Afrikaners tried to effectuate their own version of 1776, that is to say, seceding from the British Empire because they thought Britain was too liberal, believe it or not, that the Yankees, many Yankees, of course, supported the Afrikaners in the so-called Anglo-Boer War at the end of the 19th century, the beginning of the 20th century, even though by several orders of magnitude you saw that the Africans did not support the Afrikaners, just like the black people in North America did not support the secession in 1776 from the British Empire. And likewise, in the 20th century, you saw this close collaboration between South Africa and the United States. This is not only beginning with the apartheid formation in August 1948, but also before that. In fact, what's striking about South Africa, and I should, in the interest of full disclosure, I should say one of my current research projects deals with this long-term relationship, is that the Afrikaners in particular in the 1930s were collaborating with Berlin, Nazi Germany. In fact, some of the leaders of the regime in Pretoria, in fact, used to give speeches in German, which hardly anybody in South Africa understood at that time. And this is in part a reflection of the fact that the precursors of the apartheid regime were trying to incorporate former German Southwest Africa, now known as Namibia, into South Africa. Keep in mind that perhaps the first genocide of the 20th century took place in former German Southwest Africa, circa 1904, with regard to the liquidation of the Herero population in Namibia, and that in many ways this was a precursor to the genocide that unfolded in Central and Eastern Europe in the 1930s. In fact, some of the leaders in Southwest Africa, in terms of that genocide on the behalf of the Germans, were in fact in the driver's seat in terms of the genocide in Germany and in Eastern Europe and Central Europe in the 1930s. There was also close collaboration in terms of trying to experiment with how to limit the population of African descent on both sides of the Atlantic in terms of sterilization and other kinds of means. There was a very close relationship, in short, between South Africa and the United States of America. And this, of course, reaches something of a crescendo during World War II, when the South African leaders, many of them were interned because of their pro-Nazi sentiments, which makes rather ironic the comment by Ronald Wilson Reagan, the U.S. president in the 1980s, that the United States had to stand by South Africa because it had stood by the United States in wars, when in fact it was diametrically opposite, as is typical, to what Reagan actually believed. And this kind of collaboration of the South African regime with ultra-right-wing elements accelerated post-1948 with the formation of apartheid, a kind of Jim Crow on steroids, if you want to try to understand it. And this collaboration continued in the 1950s and 1960s all the way up to democratic elections in 1994 because, of course, South Africa styled itself as a citadel of anti-communism and anti-Sovietism, which it was, and its lead and the leaders of the opposition, the African National Congress, included the South African Communist Party, which, of course, was very close to Moscow. And that was the rationale for the United States collaborating with South Africa, particularly during the Reagan administration. But alas, with the fall of the Berlin Wall in 1989 and the collapse of the Soviet Union in December 1991, you began to see the Gorbachev regime retreat from its former solid support of the armed struggle in South Africa, which put enormous pressure on the ANC to negotiate a deal, which they did. This deal now, of course, is much criticized because in many ways it led to the present crisis. That is to say, a crisis whereby the Europeans kept control of the commanding heights of the economy and ceded political power. And despite the fact that the ANC has a substantial majority to this day in Parliament, the international correlation of forces right now, from their point of view, is not rather positive, because if you look at what's happened recently, look at Brazil, where the ANC comrades in the Workers' Party, Dilma Rousseff, the president, is about to be impeached and removed from office. Look at Venezuela, where Nicolas Maduro is on the ropes. Look at Russia, also part of the BRICS coalition, Brazil, Russia, India, China, and South Africa, where there's all this loose talk, as we talked about yesterday in Washington, about regime change, and war in Moscow. And so this is going to be a very steep uphill climb, particularly given the results of the election, and particularly given the fact that in neighboring Zimbabwe, where you had an attempt at redistribution of the wealth, particularly land reform, you saw a very severe counter-reaction against this attempt, including amongst many of our friends on the left in the United States. And I'm not sure people realize that land reform and redistribution of the wealth is no dinner party. Eggs are going to be cracked. Feathers are going to be ruffled. But in any case, that was a dire signal. That is to say, the attempt to drive Zimbabwe into the ditch after they moved along the path of land reform, that was a dire signal to South Africa, a dire signal to now independent Namibia. And so it's going to be a very steep uphill climb with regard to South Africa, particularly in result of these election results a few days ago.
Well, one of the things that the ANC, this is a stark warning to the ANC that something is dreadfully wrong. The ANC seems to have retreated as a concession to the notion of progress, of national progress. It seems to have retreated from its black nationalist stance. And along with that, it seems to have borrowed heavily from the U.S. political model of entrepreneurial politics, where politics is supposed to pay. Has Jacob Zuma, in fact, inflicted his own sentence, political sentence, on himself.
Well, let me now sign on to the consensus with regard to Jacob Zuma, who is being criticized and castigated from all quarters, left, right, and center. To a degree, this is understandable, because Jacob Zuma, on the personal level, in many ways has compromised the ANC. For example, when the election results were announced just a few days ago, you had a number of young women from the Economic Freedom Fighters who held up signs protesting the fact that Jacob Zuma had been acquitted after being accused of rape of the young daughter of one of his comrades, which took place 10 years ago after a scurrilous attack against this young woman and after very questionable comments, to put it mildly, with regard to President Zuma as to why he felt compelled, quote-unquote, to rape this woman, because I'm almost embarrassed to repeat his rationale. Because of the way she was dressed, he argued it would have been insulting not to move in that direction. So, but what's even worse than that is that the ANC Women's League feels compelled to defend Zuma against this victim of alleged rape, and thereby compromising the ANC Women's League. Likewise, Jacob Zuma has taken money from the public coffers to refurbish his estate on the Indian Ocean coast in Kamala. And this is an estate that, of course, houses and harbors his, I don't know how many wives he has, four or five, and maybe more. And it becomes very difficult for the ANC to style itself as the tribune of half of the population, which happens to be women and young girls, when you have such a president who is mired in corruption, who then sets the stage for other comrades to then dip their fingers into the public coffers and take whatever they can. I think, in retrospect, that it was a mistake to remove Thabo Mbeki, the predecessor of Jacob Zuma, who was replaced in an internal palace coup by the ANC a few years back, and replaced him with Jacob Zuma. Although I understand why the coup took place. One, Jacob Zuma is Zulu, and there's always been this complaint in ANC about the ANC that Zulus are underrepresented. I should also say that in these elections, the Inkatha Freedom Party, which is a kind of Zulu nationalist formation, not very progressive, to put it mildly, also did relatively well in its bastion on the Indian Ocean coast. And it was also felt that Thabo Mbeki, because of missteps with regard to dealing with the AIDS, HIV crisis, missteps with regard to how he was allegedly dealing with comrades in the trade union movement, comrades in the South African Communist Party, which is an alliance with the ANC, that he needed to go. Also, you should know that there were criticisms of Mbeki's soft line, as the opponents called it, towards Zimbabwe. And it was, if you go back and look at the press coverage, you'll get the idea that with Zuma coming to power, a hard line would then ensue. But what's striking is that with Zuma coming to power, the policies really didn't change. That is to say that supposedly Mbeki was leading the nation over the cliff and was making too many compromises with capital, and supposedly bringing Zuma to power would change all that. But the policies were always collectively defined and decided. I mean, that's how the ANC coalition works. And it was really somewhat silly, almost, to think that the policies would change just because the personnel changes. As you know from living in the United States, oftentimes people think that changing personnel changes policy. Sometimes that works. Most often it does not. Certainly it didn't work in South Africa. And then you have the other problem, which is the class question. That is to say that with the democratic elections in 1994, you have had the creation of a certain kind of wealth among certain sectors in the African population. And look at Cyril Ramaphosa, who was a lawyer during the struggle days with the miners' union, and now is one of the few African billionaires on planet Earth. And more importantly, he's the deputy to Jacob Zuma, and if Jacob Zuma is deposed, he'll probably take over. So what I'm trying to suggest is that one of a further reason for the fact that the Democratic Alliance did relatively well in these elections is that now you have certain Africans who feel that they have property that needs to be protected, and they feel that with pressure on ANC to redistribute wealth, and with DA, the Democratic Alliance, being the party of keeping wealth where it is now, that their interests would be better served voting for the DA, which is going to try to keep property where it is, as opposed to voting for the ANC, which has a trade union base, which is clamoring for redistribution. So these are parts of the contradictions that you find in the South African setup as we speak.
Wow, that was quite a history lesson in itself. We'll take the short break, and then your questions for Dr. Gerald Horn at 888-874-4888 pertaining to the subjects discussed yesterday and today, right after this. You're listening to Lead Stories on PRN.FM. I'm Eutrice Lead, and our guest is Dr. Gerald Horn. He's returning for a twofer. Yesterday we had him all day, and we're talking yesterday about the significance of the 2016 U.S. presidential elections. Today he touched on the parallel to the U.S. Presidential elections, referring to the elections in South Africa. Your calls and comments at 888-874-4888. And I just want to encourage you to be as concise as possible in framing your question so that we can accommodate as many people as we possibly can. Okay? 888-874-4888. Gerald, just as we are about to take questions, let me ask you about what I didn't get a chance to get from you the obvious parallels here in terms of the significance of these elections unfolding in South Africa and the United States. What do you see as the commonalities?
Well, first of all, let me deal with some of the significant differences. That is to say, if you look at the populations of African descent on both sides of the Atlantic, you see different paths taken during the Cold War period. That is to say that in the black population in the United States, the leadership, particularly the leadership of the NAACP, which has styled itself as something of a parallel to the African National Congress, cooperated and collaborated with the U.S. authorities in ousting and purging and silencing the left, including Paul Robeson in the first place. And that led to concessions, anti-Jim Crow concessions, to flow beginning in 1954 with the so-called Brown versus Board of Education decision, and 1964, the Civil Rights Act, 1965, the Voting Rights Act. The leadership, of course, did not recognize that those concessions were contingent upon a certain international situation dominated by the rise of a socialist camp and the rise of national liberation movements in the Caribbean and Africa, and the United States under pressure to do something about its egregious apartheid-like situation here. But once you began to see the disintegration of the socialist camp and the pushing back against national liberation movements, South Africa, for example, you then see a retreat leading directly to what we saw yesterday with the release of this stunning report on the Baltimore Police Department, which has been engaged in a kind of reign of terror against the black population, which even the Washington Post and the New York Times have characterized as racist, terms they usually do not use. They prefer the rather antiseptic term race when they actually mean racist. And this is a direct result of decisions taken by some in our leadership some decades ago. Now, look at South Africa, for example, where Nelson Mandela and the ANC chose not to accept that bargain. They were in alliance with the Communist Party throughout the days of apartheid. And then, of course, Nelson Mandela was finally freed in 1990, and that led to a negotiation that led to democratic elections in 1994. The parallels are that right now, and particularly for this population on this side of the Atlantic, the left wing is far from being in the driver's seat, to put it mildly, and the right wing is on the march, leaving us, as we noted yesterday, with some unappetizing choices with regard to the presidency. Now, of course, some amongst us are scrambling to try to prop up the Green Party. And I should note parenthetically that according to the Huffington Post, right now, with regard to the black population, Jill Stein is ahead in the polls of Donald Trump, believe it or not, and also ahead of the polls in terms of Gary Johnson of the Libertarian Party. According to the Huffington Post, Hillary Clinton is getting 83%, Jill Stein 8%, Donald Trump 1%, and Gary Johnson about 3% in the black community. Now, that's something to build upon, but it's a far cry from South Africa, where the left holds state power, admittedly circumscribed by an unfavorable correlation of forces globally, but still holding state power after going through a rocky patch during the Cold War period, where they refuse to capitulate and surrender like some of our friends in the NAACP chose to do.
888-874-4888. Your questions for Dr. Gerald Horn, based on his presentation yesterday and the continued discussion today. And anything else that you think you would like to ask him related to his previous appearances on Lead Stories, because usually when we start talking, there's so much to know. You want to listen more than ask anything. You really want to absorb as much instruction as possible, and this is what happens all the time. 888-874-4888. Frankly, I think, you know, Gerald, sometimes the information that is coming at us through you is so overwhelming, and not overwhelming in the volume only, but overwhelming in the fact that we are given information, a lot of information, and so it's a matter of trying to deal with that, and it sometimes is a bit overwhelming. So at least even for me, I could, when I'm talking with you, and of course you've spent your entire academic life researching and writing and documenting these things that are hidden. You go and ferret them out, and you present them in books and scholarly papers and in your lectures and your talks. But I don't know whether you appreciate the fact, or maybe you do, how extraordinary it is to be on the receiving end of information presented for the first time of such enormous importance. Do you get that a lot?
Well, certainly for my students, but then my students are teenagers, many of them at least, and even 9/11 is not necessarily in their historical compass. 9/11 happened when many of them were 5 or 6 years old, for example. So to a degree, with regard to my students, this is understandable, and one has to be careful with my students. And I try to take this point of view forward, even in terms of my contemporary analyses, that is to say analyses with adult audiences like you have, to try to keep things as simple as possible and try to have a kind of narrative flow and try to be explanatory in terms. But I confess and concede that sometimes I do not succeed with that approach.
Well, Henry from Chicago wants to talk with you. Henry, you're on the air with Dr. Gerald Horn.
How you doing, Utrice?
Fine, thank you.
How you doing, Dr. Horn?
Fine, thank you.
All right. I just wanted to ask this question. If I could just go off topic for just a little bit, and you've touched on this, Dr. Horn, as well in regards to the Far East. You don't mind, do you?
Oh, not at all.
Okay. Just a simple question. My mother is a Filipino, so I'm a part Filipino heritage. What is your opinion about President Duterte so far? Because you know,
Duterte Harry, as he's called.
Yeah.
President Duterte was just elected a few weeks ago in Manila. He had a tough law and order campaign and platform. He styles himself as being a law and order style candidate, and of course he's just come under fire because he released a list of leading mayors and judges and other political officials who he says are collaborating with drug dealers, even though there was no due process of law with regard to this list that he released, and there's been a lot of complaints about that, and he's coming under fire. But let me say this for Duterte Harry, or Dirty Harry, and that is that the United States is trying to guide him into a collision with China with regard to the Spratly Islands and other offshore islands that both the Philippines and China claim. And Philippines just won a case with U.S. lawyers at the World Court that China plans to ignore.
Mm-hmm.
But I think that President Duterte, at least from what I've read, he's trying to cut a deal with China rather than be a pawn or a cat's paw for U.S. imperialism, and I salute him for that. And likewise, and you can confirm if this is accurate, I've also heard that he's been much more forthcoming to left-wing forces, contrary to his law and order reputation, left-wing forces in the Philippines itself than some of his predecessors. Is that your understanding?
Yeah, actually, I read that he's trying to negotiate with the Muslim rebels in Mindanao, and also with the new Filipino army as well, which have been very much anti-government forces in the Philippines.
Mm-hmm. So I think the jury is still out. Although, like many people, I'm very disturbed by this release of these allegations against these leading officials, charging them with relations with drug dealers. Of course, Duterte Harry has a rather spectacular record with regard to dealing with drug dealers. By spectacular, I mean in terms of killing drug dealers or people accused of being drug dealers and throwing them in jail and throwing away the key. And it's a very complicated situation there.
Okay. Thanks, Henry, for your call. From Alabama, Kervin, you're on the air.
Therese, how you doing?
Fine, thank you. Your question for Dr. Horn.
Yes, how you doing, Dr. Horn?
Fine, thank you.
Okay, my question is that years ago, I think maybe around 10 years ago, I was hearing, I think his name is Joseph Molina. He was the head of the youth wing of the African National Congress.
Mm-hmm.
Are you familiar with him? Dr. Horn, are you familiar with him?
Of course. I just talked about it.
Okay, yes. I know they were mobilizing and doing some good things over there. I haven't heard anything from them in years. Do you have any information on them, or what they're actually doing at this point?
Maybe you missed what I said. They did relatively well during the elections.
Okay.
The Economic Freedom Fighters is his organization. Their platform has pledged to move in the direction of radical redistribution of the wealth. But
right.
The problem right now is that apparently, the EFF is so anti-Zuma and so anti-ANC that they are talking about going into coalition to rule certain cities with their diametric opposites, which is the Democratic Alliance, which is the descendant of the old apartheid National Party. I think that this is really going to harm them in the next elections. I don't think it's wise at all. And in some ways, the critics of the EFF would say that this is exposing Malema and the EFF. Although it's interesting to note that former President Thabo Mbeki, before the elections, allowed himself to be photographed conferring with Julius Malema. I thought that was very curious for a disciplined ANC comrade like former President Mbeki, which I interpreted as a kind of signal that perhaps voters might do well to look at their platform. But in light of this, their talks with the Democratic Alliance, well, the jury's still out, so we'll see what happens in the next few days.
Thank you for your call. Let's go to Montreal next with Randolph. You're on the air with Dr. Gerald Horn.
Yes, Dr. Horn, I'm of the opinion that the underworld has a massive stranglehold on the U.S. electoral process. And until this power is checkmated, I don't believe that there are going to be fair and honest elections. Do you believe, in view of what you're talking about in South Africa and many of the African countries, that only a revolutionary action by the people in one form or another is going to be the only way that the situation is going to change? Because even if people are elected to the highest offices in the land, they are under threat by elements who refuse to go along with the plans of people who are running the government. In other words, they end up being puppets. What is your opinion?
Well, first of all, with regard to the underworld, you're raising
and
a
I'm
very
really
complicated
sorry, I can't hear you.
Topic that could take us to the end of the hour. So let me be brief. First of all, I wrote a book called Class Struggle in Hollywood, which I dealt with the role of gangsters and the political economy of the entertainment industry generally, and the film industry
sorry,
in particular, and I recommend it to
up,
you.
Please,
second of
I
all, I wrote an article based on some of my research on the Hollywood book called Rethinking the Lumpen, Gangsters and the Political Economy of Capitalism, which you can find online. You can find it on Tumblr. You can find it on Twitter. It's all over the place. And I tried to trace the spectacular role of gangsters in the political economy of capitalism, not only in the United States, but worldwide, and then discuss how with the decline of working class movements, in particular the Socialist Project beginning some 25-odd years ago, you had a resurgence of strength of the lumpen and these gangster-like elements, which I call the big lumpen. And certainly they play an outsized role in the political economy in the United States. Just yesterday, in fact, David K. Johnston, Pulitzer Prize-winning reporter, was talking on Democracy Now! About Donald Trump and his connections to organized crime, in fact. And it would be one-sided just to see this as being limited to Donald J. Trump. I mean, that would be terribly short-sighted. And you can say the same thing with regard to South Africa in terms of gangsters. In fact, what's interesting about South Africa is they say in the streets some of the baddest gang in South Africa, in Cape Town, are called the Americans. And they dress like Hollywood movie stars of the 1940s with pinstripe double-breasted suits and pointed-toed shoes and big fedora hats. I could go on and on for the rest of the hour talking about gangsters and trying to add to your very illuminating point about their outsized role under capitalism.
Thank you, Randall, for your question. Next is Bruce from Brooklyn. Bruce, you're on the air with Dr. Gerald Horn.
Hello, Professor Horn. I'd like to talk about the issue of reparations. It seems to have lost speed over the last couple of years. How are you reading this reparations discourse at this time?
Well, I wrote an article that's in a book edited by Michael Martin for Duke University Press on the reparations movement. It came out a few years ago. And one of the things I stress is that in the United States, at least, to talk about reparations for slavery or reparations for Jim Crow, when you have such a strong right-wing movement in this country that hardly is in support of affirmative action, that's hardly in support of cracking down on police brutality, that sees Black Lives Matter as some sort of narrow nationalist movement as opposed to a life-saving movement, that you're going to have to have a reparations movement that internationalizes the question, that takes the question to the United Nations in particular. Now, there has been some of that. You might recall that a UN team came to the U.S. a few months ago. They came to Chicago in particular and issued a very stinging report rebuking the U.S. authorities. And you've also had, with regard to this police terrorism, you've had Black Lives Matter activists speaking at the United Nations. You've had the parents of Michael Brown, the slain Ferguson, Missouri teenager. We're marking the second anniversary of his murder as we speak. They've gone to Geneva to speak to the United Nations Human Rights Commission. But with regard to all of the questions that are bound up with this question of reparations, that unless it's internationalized, I think it's going to slow down considerably. And that's what I see. I don't see the kind of international effort that we really need, which is rather striking in light of the fact that we now have email. You can communicate with anybody instantaneously all over the world. You have supersonic transport. Even if you're not into email, you can send a fax all over the world instantaneously. So that's what the reparations activists need to do. They need to put more emphasis on the international community.
But Dr. Horn, Professor Horn, you had mentioned earlier about the involvement of Professor Hilary Beckles from the University of Western. He's now, I think, he's vice chancellor in Jamaica, and that was a part of the internationalization process that you mentioned. Now, I mean, do you see any movement there from the Caribbean countries, for instance, who had made an initiative? I know recently the former Prime Minister of Britain went to Jamaica, and there was some discourse about this. I mean, what do you see coming from the Caribbean in this respect?
Well, that's the bright spot. I was only speaking about the reparations movement in the United States of America. Yeah. If you take it to the Caribbean, you see more of what I'm talking about, particularly in the efforts of Professor Beckles, who you generously mentioned. I should also note that the Institute of the Black World, headed by Ron Daniels, who many of your audience is familiar with, has invited Professor Beckles more than once to IBW meetings in the United States of America. I know that the CARICOM, I just saw an article about the president of Guyana, is really prodding. He singled out not only Britain, but most of the Western European nations with regard to reparations. The only omission that I noticed was that he did mention the United States of America, which in the latter stages of the slave trade was the leading force. He might have done that for diplomatic reasons, given the outsized role the United States plays in this hemisphere. But I think the reparations struggle, our perspective on it brightens and improves once we bring the Caribbean nations into play.
Thank you for your question. We move on next to California. Yolanda, you're on the air with Dr. Gerald Horn.
Hi, Dr. Horn. My question is, do you think Julian Assange will really release, because he just said that he's going to drop some information about Hillary Clinton that will really make everybody shocked. Do you think it will happen on time for her to drop out of the election?
I'm not sure if she'll drop out of the election. Well, let me bite my tongue. I mean, because I don't know what Julian Assange has on offer. There is a front-page article in the New York Times today that suggests that the hacking of the Democratic National Committee was much more widespread than we first imagined. Apparently, it stretched to many leading Democratic Party officials, including many Democratic governors. So it's also there was also this interview that Julius Assange, who have now, as you know, is now holed up in the Ecuadorian embassy in London, where he's been for the last few years. He gave an interview, I believe, with Dutch television, where apparently the inference that was drawn by listeners, if not implied by Mr. Assange himself, was that a recent robbery and murder of a DNC official in the streets of Washington might somehow, and I'm picking my words carefully, be linked to the batch of emails that were released before the Democratic National Convention in Philadelphia and these upcoming releases that we're all expecting. We shall see, sooner rather than later, whether or not that'll drive Hillary out of the race is unclear. I mean, she's rather resilient. I mean, if these Clinton Foundation scandals and Laureate University and the scandal in Haiti have not driven her out of the race, it's difficult to see what will drive her out of the race. But we shall see soon enough.
Thank you, Yolanda, for your question. Kwame from New York, you're on the air with Dr. Gerald Horn.
Yes, hi. How are you doing, Dr. Horn?
Thank you.
Fine, thank you.
Yeah, I'd like to
You're on speaker. It really gives us too much feedback.
Okay, can you hear me now?
Yes.
Yes. I'd like to know, does the TAC, do they still exist in South Africa? And if so, do they have any impact?
Oh, we're having a really rough time. We're having a very rough time with this call. We're getting a lot of interference. I'm so sorry.
Hello, can you hear me?
Yes. No, we can't hear you too well. It's really broken up.
What about Neil?
So maybe we'll have to move on. Jose from Queens, you're on the air.
Good afternoon to two of my favorite people.
Hello, Jose. How are you? What's your question for Dr. Horn today?
Well, I'm just trying to free up my mind a little bit here. Professor Horn, there of late, you know, we have had a female prime minister of Britain, and there are those of us who believe that when you put a female in charge, that things will get somehow... Everything gets straightened out, and we have learned our lesson from Margaret Thatcher and so forth.
Right.
There is a man that she has appointed as her new foreign minister by the name of Boris Johnson.
Right.
And he has been known to make a lot of racist remarks and writings about African people. And I just want to give you this one here real quick and have your comment on it. He said, and I quote, that the best fate for Africa would be if the old colonial powers or their citizens scrambled once again in her direction on the understanding that this time they will not be asked to feel guilty. And this kind of takes me back to the whole Berlin Conference and what Otto von Bismarck said, that the reason why the Europeans are sitting down and divvying up the African continent is because Africa was unclaimed. And if they decide to do that, again, my professor, who could stop them? What could we as African people do against the onslaught of the European nations with all the mighty weapons and so forth? Who would be there to stand up for us?
Thank
you. First of all, we all need to recognize that Britain is really on the back foot right now. With this Brexit vote, this vote to withdraw from the European Union, they're scrambling to find a new role in the world. That is to say that there is some talk about Britain becoming a cat's paw of U.S. imperialism aimed at both the European Union and Russia, but Britain is a small country of 65 million. And I'm not sure if it can play that kind of formidable role. And then before Brexit, recall that London had staked out a position for itself as being China's best friend in the North Atlantic community. But now Theresa May, the British Prime Minister, has pulled the plug, at least temporarily, if not permanently, on a major multi-billion dollar Chinese-French project, Hinkley Point, a power plant. And China is hopping mad about this. And this is calling into question that relationship as well. What I'm trying to suggest to you that with regard to Boris Johnson, who has not only insulted black people, he's even insulted Hillary Clinton, saying that she resembles a sadistic nurse in a mental hospital, which actually, well, let me move on. And he's insulted President Obama, saying that he has this anti-colonial mentality because of his Kenyan roots. I think that Britain is very vulnerable right now. Mm-hmm. And I think that we can put Boris Johnson personally and London secondarily on the spot by greeting him with raucous and militant demonstrations whenever he touches down in the CARICOM nations or in the African Union nations or in North America, for that matter.
Mm-hmm. Thank you so much, Jose, for your question today.
Thanks.
Well, I don't know how you arrange this, David from Brooklyn, but you seem to be getting the last word in the last couple of...
All
so
right.
You are again. You probably
it's nice
have
to
the
talk
last
with
question
you,
with Dr. Gerald
you,
Horn.
Therese, and my professor. I was in South Africa recently, and when I got there, I took a tour, and the tour guide told
the people on the tour, all the Europeans except me and my partner, that she was colored. And we went around Cape Town, and around Cape Town I saw all these black youth walking around with their hands in their pockets doing nothing. And I went into a hotel in Cape Town, and it seemed to be very color-coded. The reception were the lighter-skinned people, people doing the janitorial work were a little darker, and it was a very interesting experience. Now, I know what has happened in Zimbabwe with the situation over there, where Mr. Mugabe has tried to make a radical distribution of wealth, and all throughout the United States and various other places, people have been very angry with him for doing that. And that has caused a problem and sanctions and that sort of thing. What I'm going to ask you is, what could be done in South Africa to have a situation where there was a greater distribution of wealth? I remember going from Cape Town to
In the interest of time, David,
Johannesburg.
I just want to, your question has been asked. I just want Gerald to be able to get to it.
Very good. Thank
because
you.
Because we're getting close to time.
Very good. Thank you.
Well, David is raising the $64 question, that is to say, how do you get to redistribution, not only in South Africa, but I would dare say in Africa as a whole, and in fact, the world, and particularly in North America. Once again, keep in mind that South Africa is a middle-sized nation of only 55 million people. Its gross domestic product, that is to say, the size of its economy, is probably not bigger than that of the Netherlands, a country of about 17 million. It tries to punch above its weight in light of the fact that it's a major power within the African Union. But the fact of the matter is, as already suggested in my previous remarks, that progress in South Africa, I'm afraid, is not only going to turn upon the domestic considerations, but also global considerations. And in light of these elections, where the right wing did rather well in the last week or so, and in light of the fact that those who are considered to be to the left of the ANC, that is to say the Economic Freedom Fighters, are now negotiating with the right wing as opposed to negotiating with the ANC, things don't look very promising right now. But as is oftentimes suggested, sometimes when things look particularly bleak, that's when the breakthrough comes. Keep in mind that in some instances, in some ways, the African slave trade was at its peak in the middle of the 19th century, just before it collapsed. So let's hope that that same kind of reasoning holds true with regard to radical redistribution of the wealth, not only in South Africa, but globally.
Well, Gerald Horn, I want to thank you so much for being with us for a second straight day. I know you had quite a bit of shuffling around to do to let your schedule accommodate today's appearance, but all the more reason for appreciating the work that you do and, more importantly, the spirit with which you do it. So I thank you so much for being available to us today, and thank you for everything you have offered us for consideration.
Well, thank you very much for those very kind words.
Thank you. All right, that brings us to the end of our program. Coming up next, Expanding Mind with Eric Davis. Really an extraordinary program. You want to stay tuned for that. You can reach me at leadstories, L-E-I-D, stories at gmail.com. As always, a pleasure and a great privilege to be in your company. Tomorrow, it's Free Your Mind Friday. Get your brains in gear. Bye-bye.